All right. We are in a red letter study. We back to a red letter study. Last week, back to a red letter study after, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks off for Easter and all sorts of things that were going on. And last week, I asked you what the most damaging attitude that you could have toward your spiritual life or toward life in general. And we threw out a whole bunch of different answers to that, which were all good, but of course not the one that I was looking for. And I was positing to you all that I think passivity is the most damaging attitude that we can have, because passivity completely disallows us from being able to move along the way of Jesus, to move along this way that he has back to the Father, to the truth that will make us free. If we're passive, you know, if we don't have the energy or the will to even the initiative to start on the journey, which takes energy. You know, we're not working for our salvation. We're not working for God's approval. We've got that. That's a given. That's built into the cosmos. But the work that we need to do is to remove all the blockages and obstacles that keep us from seeing that very fact. Because if we are still looking through our earthly eyes, we're going to see the world and we're going to see God through a legal lens. It's just natural. It's what we do because it's the way the world works. It's pay to play. It's all performance based. It's all obedience. It's all doing what we need to do in order to get the reward that we want. And if we approach God that way, we are just cooked before we begin. If we don't understand that God is love, is forgiveness, is acceptance, is all of those things that we say we want, and all we have to do is approach God in order to get those things, you know? I think I put something on Facebook a while back, a picture of a tree and sunshine, and it's just like, you know, God's love is like a tree, you know. You don't need to do anything to get shade. You just need to get next to the tree. It's the same thing with God's love. You don't need to do anything for it. You just need to get close to God, and you get it. It's just that way. But the legal aspect is what cuts us away from that, and that's where we default to every single time, because it's the way the world works. In this physical realm, it's the way the world works. There's a lot of work that we have to do to get past all that, to understand there's a completely different way of looking at life. And following rules is passive. If you follow rules unquestioningly, if you follow church doctrine unquestioningly, if you never resist where resistance is absolutely what love requires, then you are also passive. Jesus resisted where resistance was necessary. It got him killed. Jesus was always challenging the status quo. Jesus was always questioning everything and encouraging us to do the same. Where did we get off the train at some point where we just sat in unquestioning authority? That's passive, and that's not Jesus' way. What Jesus is trying to do is to get us from this legalism, from this passivism, away into a new way of looking at life and living life, because that passivity cannot get us into kingdom. And Jesus is absolutely relentless about this. He just keeps pounding away, systematically pounding away. He never lets us rest in our old ideas. Not for a moment. Just when you think you got them figured out. Just when you think it's safe to go back in the water. He throws another curve at you, and we're off to the races again. This is what he's doing. Constantly tearing down those attitudes which will preclude us, which will keep us from being able to see the truth as the truth really is, to see God as God is, which is the same thing. God is truth. Truth is the engagement in love and not some thought we carry around in our heads. This is everything that he's trying to get across to us. These passive and legal attitudes have got to go. He's like a relentless trainer, or maybe a physical therapist, yeah? Relentless physical therapist. One more rep. One more rep. You can do it. One more. Because anything that we rest in, anything that we become complacent in, anything that becomes too familiar that we don't see it anymore, becomes passive. And it's shelving us off from the always moving Spirit of God. Jesus is systematically relentless. He starts in the Sermon on the Mount with the Beatitudes, right at the beginning of chapter 5. And he gives us these 7 or 8 ways, depending on how you want to count, of looking at this person who is living in kingdom and all the upside down traits, the ones that we don't value in a legal system, in this worldly system. We don't value any of the traits that are listed in the Beatitudes because it's completely upside down. It's the meek, it's the servants, it's the invisible, it's the ones who are poor in spirit, have that attitude of poverty even if they're rich, are the ones that he says are at the forefront. Those are the ones who are in kingdom. He's turning those ideas upside down, and he flows right from that into a complete retake of the law. Let's look at the law completely differently. You think all you have to do is obey. No, that's passive. What is the condition of your heart? You think you're safe just because you didn't murder someone. Even if you have a hard thought toward that other person in your heart, you've already become guilty before the court. He's taking it back to the inside out, always leaning forward, always moving further into deeper into relationship, always looking for the next ability and moment to be able to connect. And then when he crosses over into chapter 6, now he's going to do the same thing for righteousness. Those three areas of righteousness that the Jews had codified really as more law. You had to give to the poor, you had to pray, and you had to fast. And you had to do it in such a way that it filled and checked all the boxes and filled all the spaces so that then you could be considered righteous. If we keep pursuing all of this legally, as Jesus said, if we pursue these righteous attitudes and this law in this way, then we have our reward in full. He says that over and over again. If you pray in front of people to make a big spectacle, if you give in front of people to make a big spectacle, if you let them know that you're fasting so they can see how righteous you are, yeah, you've gone someplace in the social and cultural ladder, but you have your reward in full. There is no more. Because you can go no further along the way with that attitude, Jesus' way, capital W. You can't. You've got everything that you're going to get. You can't move further into the truth, into God's presence with those kinds of attitudes. And he caps this all off with two illustrations, the ones that we read last week. He says, you know, don't store up your treasures here on earth, where rust and moths and thieves can take it all away from you, but store it up in heaven where none of that can happen, where it's permanent. It's not temporary like it is here. It's absolutely permanent because where your treasure is, there your heart is as well. And remember, we talked about that the heart, leba in Aramaic, really is talking about our whole center of being, everything that makes us tick. It's the center of our courage. It's the center of our emotions. It's the center of our action. It's what motivates us. It's our essence that motivates us into action. And so if we are storing up treasures on earth, that means that those treasures, those things that we say we value, have come to possess us, have come to define us. That's who we are now. In that understanding, in valuing those things so much, in relying on those things. But he says, no, store it up in heaven. And remember, heaven is not the place that we think of heaven usually. Heaven isn't in the afterlife, there, then, someplace. Heaven is a euphemism for God. Shemaiah is a word that the Jews used instead of saying God's name and for fear of taking it in vain. And so he's saying you store up your treasures in God. And that doesn't just mean in some amorphous God. That's in what God values. In other words, we value what God values, our treasures, or what God treasures, so that everything is being transformed inside, and then everything that flows from that in our feelings and in our behavior looks like law, looks like God. And then he talks about the eye, that the eye is the lamp of the body, and if the eye is clear, and the word in Aramaic is peshitta, which means sincere and simple and true, if it is sincere, then the body will be full of light. And light, neura, is not just visible light, but it means order, it means intelligence, it means clarity. But if your eye is bisha, if it's bad, if it's immature, if it's unripe, if it's unready, then your body will be full of darkness, heshuka, which is chaos and disorder and dysfunction. Let your eye be clear. Let your heart be completely fixed on what God's heart is fixed on. And so the eye and the heart become his big metaphors here. For the sum of all of our thoughts, You know, all of the ways that we think, because Aina, I, means your worldview, the way that you see. And so the way that you see, your worldview, the way that you look at life, and what you feel about yourself, that center of your being and the center of your action, what motivates you to action, is everything about what action you take. The way we look at life affects what we feel, the attitudes we have, and the action that we take. And if that action we take, if that whole combination of our worldview and our center of action is fear-based, that is, we're worried about punishment, right? We're worried about not getting the advantage that we want to get. If we're focused on that, then we're always going to be focused, first of all, on ourselves, and we're going to be focused on our personal survival. We're going to be focused on material things, and we're going to be focused on performance. All complete kingdom killers, because it shelves us off from being able to see the absolute truth. We just can't see God's presence. We can't see God's nature if that's the way we're focused. Jesus is being absolutely relentless here, but not to make us incrementally better, right? He's not just trying to make us a little bit more moral, you know, a little bit more obedient. He's not trying to make us a little bit more anything. He's not trying to be incremental here. He's trying to get us in a completely different vehicle. I know I've used this illustration before, but hopefully it works. You know, the fastest and the greatest mode of travel across the earth is a jet airplane. Nothing goes faster, right? It's the greatest way to get from point A to point B, unless point B is in a low orbit. A plane needs air to get lift. Once the air thins out, it can't go any further. If where you want to go is not of this world, you can double think that one, right? Then an airplane is not going to take you there. The law is not going to take you there. Church doctrine is not going to take you there. It can't do it. It can only point the way. But if you want to get into orbit, you got to get out of the airplane and get into a rocket ship that can attain escape velocity. It's just the way it is. Jesus isn't trying to incrementally get us to a place where we are now acceptable to God. He's telling us you got to get out of this car completely. You got to tear it all down to the ground and have absolute new eyes and new ears to hear and to see that there is a completely different vehicle that will take you where you need to go. And it looks like nothing you've ever seen on this earth. And that's a problem because it's so hard for us to believe, right? The old vehicle cannot get us to kingdom. And of course, kingdom is not heaven. Kingdom is not the place or the place of afterlife. It is God, really, God himself. It is the ability to see God's presence, to see God's truth that frees us from all the fear. That's what kingdom is, living that way right now, because perfect love is the only thing that casts out fear. And when we can do that, when we have finally apprehended enough of the God's absolute love, that degreeless and completely indiscriminate love, then we can start living from a love base instead of a fear base. And everything begins to change. Let's take a look at the way that Jesus puts it. And right at Matthew 6:24, he tells us that no one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. And, of course, the word that is translated there is mammon. And remember, mammon doesn't just mean wealth. There is nothing wrong with wealth. There is nothing wrong with a healthy bank account. There's nothing wrong with the things in your house. It's okay. It's when those things that you have piled up because you really believe that they are your salvation and they have come to define you, now it's a problem. It's what you value more than the interior things that Jesus is talking about that is the problem. You cannot serve God and mammon. And of course, this idea of hate, sana in Aramaic, doesn't mean the malicious sort of hate that we think. It just means to prefer less. So if you are going to love one, then you're going to prefer less the other. That's just the way that it works. If we're devoted to one, we're going to despise the other. Because we're going to be defined by what we actually value and put all our eggs in. That is what is going to obliterate everything else. We won't be able to see the perfect love of God. We're only going to be able to see the fear-based system that keeps us on the hamster wheel, keeps us trying to perform more and more. Jesus is literally saying you can't plow two rows at once. Can't do it. You can't follow two paths back to unity, because already you've split the difference. Unity is one thing. And Jesus says there is only one way to the Father. Look at me. I'm that way. See what I do. Do what I do. And it's important for us to remember also that God is not punishing us. He's not saying, okay, you didn't do it right, so you're not getting in. It has nothing to do with that. You're already in as far as God is concerned. You can't be any more in as far as God is concerned. But you simply won't be able to see the door. You won't be able to see him. You'll walk right past God to keep searching for the God of your own understanding, which has nothing to do with the God that Jesus is talking about. You know, we were Wednesdays for the Just This book study. I played a little video at the beginning of last Wednesday, and it was Thomas Merton, just an audio clip of Thomas Merton. Now, for those of you who don't know Thomas Merton, he was a Trappist monk, really active in the 40s and 50s and 60s. He died in 1968. But he is understood as probably one of the few spiritual masters that the United States has produced. You know, we don't produce a lot of spiritual masters, apparently. Yeah, but he's one of the few. He's Catholic, Trappist monk, right? He's also understood to be the one who really brought contemplative practice back in as a popular part of popular culture back in the 50s and the late 40s. And he is just someone who has really been a mentor of mine. And I had been reading him for probably, 20 years before I finally heard a recording of his voice. And it's kind of interesting, you know, we're talking about how God is an unassuming God and God is humble and not what you're going to expect. You know, when I think of Thomas Merton, he had risen to this huge pedestal in my mind, right? And you hear his voice and it's kind of a thin, high-pitched, you know, not terribly impressive voice or anything like that. And he speaks just colloquially, just a regular guy. You know, he's not any great orator or anything like that. But what he has to say, the content, you know, is amazing. But what he was saying in this little clip, and it was his last address to the monks at the abbey before he went into the hermitage. He spent his last 3 years in a hermitage all by himself on the properties of the monastery. But he was trying to get across to them that this world that we live in is a transparent world. It's absolutely transparent. And God is constantly shining through this world. Always. Wherever you go, wherever you look, every view that you have, it's transparent and God is shining through. You can't get away from God. It's impossible to be anywhere where God is not. And yet to us and to our eyes, the world is opaque. We don't see the transparency. We don't see God shining through. All we see is the flat surface of the things. And he said, what makes it opaque for us? And he called it care. He said, when we care. Now, maybe we want to say when we're attached. Maybe we want to say when we're preoccupied. But what he was talking about is when we focus on one thing, you know, he says, even if it's just a rabbit, and you're focused on the rabbit, and you're thinking about the rabbit, he said, it's like getting this opaque package, you know, that's wrapped either for Christmas or maybe just for the post, and you're spending all this time, you're taking off the strings and you're unwrapping this thing and you're trying to get down to what it is that a rabbit really is, and when you get the whole thing unwrapped, there's nothing there because it was all in your mind. We spend our time moving from object to object, opaque to opaque to opaque object, unwrapping and analyzing and thinking about these things, and the whole world stays opaque to us. He said, if we just step back and we just relax and we just see the rabbitness, you don't see the rabbit, you see the rabbitness of God in whatever it is you're experiencing, then suddenly everything transforms and the world becomes transparent again and God shines through. It's a completely different way of processing. You know, we've been calling it awareness without thinking about it. You're aware of things, but you don't think about them. You know, I love those old things back in the 90s, I think they were. You'd see them in all the shops where they have a picture. It kind of looked like pointillism. They called it the magic eye, I think. And, you know, this like abstract art, and it had all these points and everything. And you're just looking at the thing, and it just looks like a bunch of points of color. But if you step back and you kind of let your eyes cross a little bit, you just relax. And then suddenly it opens up into a 3D image of something. You know, one of them was dinosaurs, you know, going through their habitat. And all of a sudden it opens up. But then if you focus again, it's just opaque. You know, it's kind of like that. But it's interiorly, you know, just relaxing and allowing things to become transparent again. To see not just an object, but the object in the whole and the whole in the object, so that everything becomes one thing. That's what contemplation can do for us. It allows us to unfocus the mind's thought patterns the way the eye can unfocus to see the image. I don't know if that did anything for you. I just spent, 4 or 5 minutes on it. But, you know, if it helped, great. If it didn't, never mind, let's move on. But it's an important point for us to get one way or another. This world, everything is here. God is here. The world is transparent. What Jesus is trying to get us to do is to show us how to see in this way that Merton is talking about. See that transparency. You know, encouraging us to do the work that we have to do in order to be able to see that way. And it's hard work. You have to sell everything that you own. You have to sell everything that you think you know and all those things you rely on. You have to pick up your cross daily, deny yourself, in order to follow this way. It's a constant relinquishing, a constant relinquishing. And it's not passive. Maybe it sounds passive because you're just letting things go, but it requires everything of us to be able to do this. But not in the way we think it would. That's more old thinking. That's more of the bad eye. Because it's not about acquiring something that we don't have. It is about relinquishing. Think about it. Acquiring is fear-based. Relinquishing is love-based. Why would I say that? You know, if someone just says you're white-faced in fear, you heard that expression before? White-faced. You know why that is? Why does someone blanch? Why does someone turn white when they get afraid? You know, it's because the body is pulling all the blood in from the extremities, right? In anticipation of a fight. So if you get hit, if you get cut, you're not going to bleed that much, and it's protecting the vital organs inside. The body does that naturally. But think about what we do psychologically in the same way. When we're fear-based, we're trying to bring everything in. We're trying to hoard it. We're trying to build our defenses and build our walls really thick. But when we're love-based, what happens? We become transparent, don't we? We just open up. We become vulnerable. We become hurtable because we are letting this person, this thing, whatever it happens to be that we're in love with, see who we really are. Acquiring is fear-based. Relinquishing is love-based. How do you know when you've crossed over? How do you know when you're actually seeing God as God is? How do you know when you're becoming free enough to live in a love-based way, to live this way of relinquishment? Well, how do you know if you're free of something at all? How do you know if something is free for you, right? Well, the only thing that I can really think of that's free anymore that they haven't found a way to tax yet is air. So unless you're a scuba diver or an astronaut, you still get air for free, right? And if you really analyze how you process the freeness of air, is that you don't think about it. Do you really think about your breathing? Do you think about the air? You think about it if it's not there, right? Or you think about it if it smells bad, but otherwise, you don't think about it, you don't plan for it, you don't pay for it, you don't work for it. You just make no never mind. Something that is free is like that. Now think about your car loan. Is that free? But what happens when you pay it off? You don't have to think about the loan anymore. It is now free. A mortgage, same way. Something is free if we don't have to think about it, worry over it, plan for it, stress over it. That's how we know when something is free. So the question is God's love free? Yeah, we're instinctively going to say yeah. But what do we really believe? How much do you worry over God's love? How much do you worry over salvation? How much do you worry and think about and plan for and work for being right with God? Hopefully not as much as you used to, but how much is still there in the back of your mind? How much do you wonder, am I really being led into error by this clown on stage here? Is this okay? Can I go this far? Can I really think these things and God isn't going to get me? There's so much that is pounded so deep into us. It's really hard to get free of all this. That's why Jesus is so relentless about all of this. Legalism is all about worry. Legalism is all about worrying. If you want to know where you stand, think about how much you worry. Whatever you're worrying over is not free for you. Whatever you're thinking, planning for, stressing over is not free for you. And this is where Jesus is going in this next section. He's illustrating with concrete images again for his time and his people, and he's giving four principles for this way through which we can move from passivity, fear, and worry over until to activity and love and trust. Take a look at Matthew 6, starting at verse 25. For this reason, I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, or for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life worth more than food and the body more than clothing? Okay. So for this reason, he starts out. For what reason? Well, for the reason that you can't serve two masters, right? That's the section right before. Because you can't serve two masters, because you will hate one and love the other, that you can't serve God and wealth, then I say to you, do not be worried about your life. Do not be worried about all of these things that you worry about so much. Look deeper, in other words. Look deeper than the surface. Look deeper than the seen world, the opaque world that we see all the time. Because life is worth more than these things that you're worrying over. Life is made of different stuff altogether. It's more than food. It's more than clothing. In other words, stop looking at those individual objects that make the world opaque. The objects of the seen world are kind of like the sun. The sun rises in the morning and obliterates the stars. Now, we know the stars are still there. They haven't moved. But we can't see them because of the sun. Our consciousness does the same thing. It obliterates everything else that we can't see. In contemplation, we're learning to set the sun of our consciousness so the stars can come back out, so we can see life more transparently as it actually is. This is what Jesus is trying to teach us to do. If we focus on these opaque things, then everything gets lost. But that unseen world, that transparent world, is just as real as the one that we can see. But if we focus on that, if we think on that, if we turn it into a theology, then it becomes just as opaque as everything else. It's only in the real-time experiencing, as we unfocus, that we can experience the all in the everything and that pure presence that we're talking about. So Jesus is saying, look deeper. Don't be content with just object to object and these things that you're so concerned about. Let yourself go a little bit unfocused and see what's beneath the surface. And then he says in verse 26, look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? And so here are the birds. Are the birds really free from work? Does the Heavenly Father just feed them and they just get to sit around on a branch all day and get seeds from heaven? If you really take a look at a bird, you'll see that they are working constantly. All their waking life, they're doing something that has to do with their survival. But what Jesus is saying here is to stay present. Look deeper and stay present. Because all this about sowing and gathering into barns, all that is pointing to the future. It's taking you away from the present right now. Does that mean that you don't save? Does that mean you don't have a bank account? Of course not. We can do those things. But are we so preoccupied? Do we care so much about those things that they're another wrapped package that we're trying to unwrap and making the rest of the world opaque? Or can we do those things and still be here, be now, and allow the world to be transparent? Birds exist only in the present. That's why we call them bird brains. I know. But they only exist in the present, as small children do too. They only exist in the present. That's no virtue on their part. It's just who they are. But we can learn to do the same thing, and we can learn to balance between the two. And that's what Jesus is trying to get us to understand. Think about it. 90% of what we worry about never comes to pass anyway. Really. Think about the things that you have worried about in the past. How much of it really came to pass? And 0% of your worrying does any good or changes an outcome anyway. And we need to distinguish between worrying and preparation. Yeah, do your preparation, do your due diligence, do your work. But once you've done it and you've done everything you can, then put it aside and come back home again. Don't continue to just rotate it through your brain over and over as worry. None of that does any good. And 100% of our worrying destroys the present moment. Absolutely makes the world completely opaque. And it also destroys relationships as well. Yes, our minds are capable of thinking about past and the future, but only the present actually exists. And it's only in the present that we can actually be free, that we can actually experience and know the truth that Jesus is talking about. There's a quote from a movie that's in your handouts. I just wanted to read, just see if this helps to drive this point home. It says, "Root yourself in this present moment now. Root yourself in this present moment now. Sight, sound, smell. What do you feel? Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all just telling ourselves a story." Think about that. The worry, the fear, just a product of our minds. And then in verse 27, Jesus says, "All of you who by being worried," and you, and let me try that third time as a charm. "And who of you, by being worried, could add a single hour to his life?" Now, if you happen to be one of those King James only people, it's going to read a little differently. It's going to say, "A cubit to your stature, a cubit to your height." Well, what was a cubit? A cubit was the distance from your elbow to your fingertips, so it's about 18 inches. It was just an ancient unit of measure that was convenient, right, for them. You always had your arm with you. So the actual word there is cubit, as it translates from the Greek or translates from the Aramaic, but it's being used metaphorically here. So yes, it can refer to a single hour to your life, a moment to your life, or it can be another inch to your height. Either way, you're getting the point that Jesus is throwing down here, right? He's saying to you, accept your vulnerability. Look deeper, stay present, and accept your vulnerability. Luke 12 in the parallel adds this: "If you can't do that which is least, why worry about the rest?" Don't you love that? You can't turn one hair white or black, Jesus also adds in another passage. You can't do any of these things. Why are you worried about all these other things? You can't do the most basic things of life. Do you understand how vulnerable you are? Do you understand how dependent you are? Do you understand how little control you have over all of this? And you think by worrying you're going to add anything to anything? The most basic facts of life are out of our control. Accept your dependence. Accept that you are vulnerable. Stop pretending that you can do anything to change that basic fact of life. It's who you are as a human being. And no matter how many zeros there are in your bank account, no matter how many guard gates between you and that street out there, you are still vulnerable. You are still dependent. And there is nothing you can do to change that. And it's exhausting to keep trying. It's fear-based, and it keeps the world completely opaque. Can't we just rest in that vulnerability, in who we are? Be okay with that and learn that it's only in that vulnerability that we can actually move to trust. And trust is everything. Brennan Manning said he thinks it means more to God to hear us say, "I trust you," than "I love you." And I think he's absolutely right. Because when you have trusted someone, that means you have walked down the road with them long enough to know that they are trustworthy. You have risked something in the relationship, and you have been rewarded with the trustworthiness of that person. That says so much more than just "I love you," which can come from anywhere. And maybe just a feeling. "I trust you" implies intimate familiarity and relationship. And we cannot get there until we start to rest in our vulnerability and accept that we are. And then at verse 28. "And why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, they do not spin. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all of his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith?" So we got flowers in the field now. Notice how beautifully Jesus just weaves in all the experience of his listeners into everything that he's doing. Nothing is pulled out of the abstract. It's right here, right where they are, something that they can see. It brings it home to them. Now, what is he saying? He's saying, see the perfection in the moment. See that perfection. Look deeper, stay present, accept your vulnerability, and now see the perfection that is right here, in this moment, right now. Let it be enough for you. Solomon, with all he had, the most fabulously wealthy man of antiquity, could do no better than right here in this field, looking at these flowers that cost us absolutely nothing. Now, plants are not capable of thought. Plants are not capable of striving like the birds. Their perfection, their beauty, comes from simply being exactly what they are. And anything added to them would only be less than perfect. I have to realize that. Once you have moved and leaned into the moment and let it be enough, anything taken away or added would make it less so, not more so. It's not about acquiring. It's about just letting it be. This is everything Jesus is talking to is coming to a point here. Stop analyzing those opaque packages. See what is all of creation. Everything is in everything that we see. And let go of the thought. Stop trying to add. Stop trying to acquire. All creation is in us. And we are in the whole as well. If you can see that, see how it all fits together, how everything belongs in its place, then we can see the perfection in the moment. And then he sums up at verse 31. "Do not worry then, saying, 'What will we eat? What will we drink? Or what will we wear for clothing?' For the Gentiles," and that means those who are not following our ways, those who do not know our God, eagerly seek all of these things. "For your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care of itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. And I think truer words were never spoke, right? Gosh. It's beautiful what he does here. It's beautiful how he puts this all together. Once we can actually see this truth, once we can actually realize that the truth is when we're engaged in the motion of love and relationship and connection and not just considering thoughts in our head. That's when all else is added. That's when everything just comes into focus. That's when that transparency reasserts. And we can say with Paul that we're content in all our circumstances. We don't have to change the circumstances in order to be content. We're not talking about ecstatically happy here, but content, knowing that everything is okay. Everything is in balance. And you know what the next line that Jesus will utter here as we cross the line into chapter 7? Do not judge. Do you see how all of this is fitting together? Do you see the progression here that's going on? This fear that we have that causes us to worry, this fear that we have that blocks and makes the world opaque, right? Blocks God from shining through. This truth of the love that is here, that is the basic artifact of creation, is here. That fear creates the need for us to acquire, creates the need for us to obey. And then once we're invested in that legal system, we're going to live by those standards. Those standards become everything that we know and everything that we do in order to survive. And then we judge everyone and everything by those standards from that perch. And that's exactly what Jesus says. It says, don't judge, because the standard you use will be used on you. Not in a punitive way, not by some outside force. We're doing it to ourselves. We're always doing it to ourselves. Because God has already chosen, and he's chosen us. To the extent that we don't live that, don't see that, don't know that, that's our choice. And it makes life a living hell. Look around at the world. What do you see? All these things that we know are so out of focus. Where are they coming from? They're coming from people living in that fear base. They're people coming from needing to acquire. They're people coming from building their defenses and thinking that they have to take the next piece of land in order to have more defense, and the next piece after that. More power. More stuff. And think about your own home. To the extent that the dysfunction there exists, where is that coming from? The exact same place. This is how we end up doing what we're doing. This living hell that we create for ourselves is playing out in our lives, micro and macro. Because if we really, even for a moment, saw the truth, right, became free enough to actually begin to trust, then we could relinquish this worry. We could still work really hard the way the birds do, but we would do it in present tense. We'd be working for what we're working for with an awareness of the future, an awareness of the outcome we're striving for, but never in a way that it makes the present moment opaque. We can still be transparent. Now, what does that actually look like? I have a little story for you. And this comes from the ancient desert fathers, one of my favorite sources. Just listen to the story and see what you think. Abbot Anastasius had a book written on very fine parchment, which was worth 18 pence, and had in it both the Old and New Testaments in full. Once a certain brother came to visit him, and seeing the book, made off with it. So that day, when Abbot Anastasius went to read his book and found that it was gone, he realized that the brother had taken it. But he did not send after him to inquire about it, for fear that the brother might add perjury to the theft. Isn't that considerate? Well, the brother went down to the nearby city in order to sell the book, and the price he asked was 16 pence. The buyer said, "Give me the book that I might find out whether it is worth that much." And with that, the buyer took the book to the holy Anastasius and said, "Father, take a look at this book, please, and tell me whether you think I ought to buy it for 16 pence. Is it worth that much?" Abbot Anastasius said, "Yes, it is a fine book. It is worth that much." So the buyer went back to the brother and said, "Here is your money. I showed the book to Abbot Anastasius, and he said, it's a fine book and is worth at least 16 pence. But the brother asked, "Was that all he said? Did he make any other remarks?" "No," said the buyer, "he did not say another word." "Well," said the brother, "I have changed my mind, and I don't want to sell this book after all." Then he hastened to Abbot Anastasius and begged him with tears to take back his book. But the abbot would not accept it, saying, "Go in peace, brother. I make you a present of it." But the brother said, if you do not take it back, I shall never have any peace. And after that, the brother dwelt with Abbot Anastasius for the rest of his life. See, this stuff is so beyond the way we think. It's just, you read something like that and says, who in the world would act that way? There is absolutely no need on the abbot's part to justify himself, to get justice, to punish, to correct, to do anything at all. Fairness for him is not the issue at all. There is no conflict in his mind. Everything is focused on the welfare of the thief. He can just relinquish even a cherished book of his own. All the choices he makes flow from that one essence, that one motivation. What is the best for this brother who has stolen my book? Do you think you could do that? Could you even see that as a virtue? See, that's the key. Some of these things are so radical in the way they really present in life, we don't even see that as a virtue. We see that as another evil. And that's the first thing that has to go. We have to start to see with different eyes enough to see at least the possibility that there's something here that we can emulate, something here that is taking us in a direction we desperately want to go. But this judgment of ours is so deeply ingrained, it's hard to believe that it's not righteous. We have made a virtue out of judgment and offense taking and all the other things that we do. But once we begin to see the truth of this unseen world, this transparent world, then we can lose the attachment to the objects that make it opaque. And that includes the thought forms that drive us, our eyes and our heart. Then we can relinquish more and more, even of the things that we retain. We're not going to empty out our homes and our bank accounts, but those things that we retain can be relinquished internally so they don't have that hold on us anymore. They're simply a tool that we use, a means to an end that we need. There was another desert father called Serapion, and what he did was he sold the book that told him to sell everything and give it to the poor. He sold his treasured copy of the New Testament that told him to sell everything. Do you see how the connection with God's values, the identification with God's values, changes the calculus on everything else that we encounter and everything that we own? God knows what we need. We know what we need. And we're going to continue to work to provide them for ourselves and for our dependents. Of course, we're going to do that, but never at the expense of making the world opaque. That's what Jesus is trying to get across. Because as long as God is still shining through this transparent world, then we are still in love. And that's where Jesus is trying to get us to go. Let's pray. Father, we want to be in love. What's better than being in love? What's better than being in that state where all the colors are brighter and the food tastes better and everything's exciting the way it was when we first saw it? When all our defenses are down, when our heart is absolutely open and vulnerable and hurtable, but the feeling is so breathlessly great. Because there is nothing standing between us and the beloved. Father, we want to be in love with you. We want to be in love with your creation that you inhabit and fill. We want to see your creation as you see it transparently. Help us to be more and more willing and able to let go of the things we cling to in fear so that we can live this life of relinquishment. And then, paradoxically, find everything that is in you. Help us, Lord. Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. It's hard for us to do these things, but you know exactly how hard it is. Help us every step of the way. Help us to see more and more that you are there. And never let us forget we can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.